When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Jewelry isn't a gift you give just once. It's a way to remind your loved one of a beautiful moment every time they see it. Blue Nile can help you find the gift that says how you feel and says it beautifully, with expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com and experience the convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com to find the perfect jewelry gift for any occasion. BlueNile.com.
This is the Ridiculous Ashes podcast. I'm Dan Lipke, and with me is Alex Bowden.
Hello.
We are covering historical Ashes series to find out which nation is more ridiculous at cricket, England or Australia. And the series that we are covering this time around is the 1981 Ashes.
Yes, and this is the second test of the series. To quickly recap the format, each test we highlight the most ridiculous moments delivered by each side, and then award points to a top three, and most points wins that ridiculous test match regardless of the actual result. England took the first ridiculous test in this series thanks to dropping pretty much everything that came their way, and Bob Woolmer's heroic attempt to fix a number three problem by scoring a pair, which was a neat attempt to solve a problem, but not very productive. Australia earned a couple of consolation points via some self-satisfied Dennis Lilly footwork, which prevented a boundary but not a four. Before we get into this test nominations, Dan's going to tell us how things unfolded.
Yeah, so in this second test, Kim Hughes won the toss, and once again he asked England to bat first, and it was perhaps not as good a decision as the in the first test, because this looked like a much better batting pitch, and England made their way to 284 for four, but suddenly the wicket of top scorer Peter Willey triggered a collapse of 6 for 27, and England stumbled their way to 311 all out, with Geoff Lawson finishing with the figures of 7 for 81. Very good figures. In reply, Australia made 345 thanks to Alan Border combining with the tail. That meant they had a first innings lead of 34. And so with time running out in the test, England raced along at 2.68 runs per over. Geoffrey Boycott scored 60 off just 211 balls, and David Gower raced to 89 off 207, as they declared in the middle session of the final day, setting Australia 232 for victory. Australia then lost three quick wickets, but Graham Wood and Alan Border saw them safely to stumps, and the second test ended in a draw.
Yeah. Do you want to go first this time? Because my final nomination is kind of, well, without a spoiler, it's kind of post-match. So I think we'll finish with that one. So if you go first.
I will go first, and I will start off with what I think is my strongest nomination, and this is the magnificent entrance of Ray Bright to this 1981 Ashes. And I'm not sure how much you remember or knew about Ray Bright as a bowler. I knew the name because it's, you know, this wonderful solar-powered name, but it's that's pretty much all I knew about him. I could have also told you that he was a spinner, and that was about it.
Yeah, I knew the name, and I would have told you he was probably a spinner. I would have probably committed to that.
Yes. But apart from that, you know, I had no other expectations. Much like Richie Beno, who announced at the start of the match that Australia were forced to play Ray Bright, which was not exactly the kind of ringing endorsement you want to hear from the Australian commentator in the box. they were forced to acclaim due to Rodney Hogg back spasms, which Rodney Hogg back spasms sounds like a great name for an album or something. anyway, I was not at all prepared for Ray Bright's entry into this series, which was a genuine laugh out loud moment. It's primarily a visual gag, so we will be posting, you know, an animated GIF of it on social media, but I will do my very best to describe it. So the framing of what happens with Ray Bright's first delivery is what makes the entire thing work. So you've got the camera angle from behind the batter. Mike Gatting is facing up, and we can see Rod Marsh up to the stumps, crouched down, and in the very bottom right of the camera, there's a slip fielder just creeping into frame. Then up the top is the umpire and the non-striker standing to the umpire's right, which is our left as we look at it. And then the commentator announces Ray Bright to Mike Gatting, and suddenly Ray Bright emerges, not from the top of the screen as you traditionally expect from a bowler running into bowl, but instead he enters from stage left, not quite at right angles to the pitch, but certainly coming in at a far, far flatter angle than I had ever expected. So yes, he runs in, he somehow squeezes between the non-striker and the umpire, continuing between the umpire and the stumps, and then he kind of just straightens sharply to bowl, essentially right angled left arm round the wicket off spin. It was absolutely magnificent. It looked like he ran in from the change rooms. They just appeared from nowhere. Forget, you know, boring old balls of the century. Any old leg spinner could do that. This, in my opinion, is the greatest delivery that Mike Gatting ever received.
Yeah, I would heartily agree with that. And I would heartily agree it was like a laugh out loud moment as well. Because what's so magnificent about it is that everyone else is arranged correctly in just the most perfectly normal way. The batter's in the normal position, the umpire's in the normal position, non-striker, the fielders, everything's, it's so mundane and it's so familiar. And as you're watching it on in the middle of a highlights package, it's just yet another delivery. You have no sense of what's to come. And then this character just inserts himself from the most unexpected angle, and it's really, really jarring to watch. And yeah, sort of underlining how comic this is, I noted later in the match that most of the time he seems to run in basically pretty normally, like maybe from a slightly wider angle than most bowlers, but not sideways. He doesn't crab in.
you kind of wonder whether he'd like given his cap to a fielder at mid-wicket or something and then thought, oh, screw it, I'll just run in from here.
I'll just go from here.
Yeah, absolutely magnificent. That is my first nomination. Ray Bright making a startling entrance.
Yeah, I confidently say you won't improve on that one. It's really, really hard to do it justice, just how unlikely it is, the angle of approach. Speaking of like funny run-ups, though, my first nomination is Bob Willis, and specifically Bob Willis's 28 no balls in 27.4 overs, which a quite Herculean effort.
Yes.
So that's an extra 4.4 overs that he delivered. And then just sort of compounding. This is in one innings.
Yes.
And then compounding that, Graham Dilley bowled another 14 on top of that. So it was a real no-ball fest from England.
It was very impressive. So if he bowled 28 no-balls in 27, he's basically bowling 7 ball overs, right? Every over.
Yeah, he's splitting the difference between 6 ball overs and 8 balls overs. Bob's going to bowl 7.
Yeah. Fantastic.
It's fair to say Willis had an issue with no balls. He bowled 939 of them in Test cricket.
Deserved 1,000.
Yes, deserved 1,000. His mate and former teammate Bob Paul Allett reckoned that with Bob's run-up, that equated to around 50 extra miles of running in, which is, it's really quite something. And this was a real pure example of that.
Yeah, pretty much every time you looked up, the umpire was just, oh, I'll stick my arm out for that one. You've overstepped again, Bob. Yeah, I guess the thing that I liked about all these no balls that because they flashed them up because the commentators were banging on about them, and it did remind me, I'd mostly forgotten about the idea that in those days, if you scored a run off a no ball, the total was credited only with the runs off the bat, so there were no extra runs for the no ball. You just had to bowl it again, which meant that there was a mismatch between the number of balls that they were claiming Willis and Dilley bowled and the number of no balls on the scorecard, which was just, oh yeah, that's right, I remember those days.
Yeah, it kind of camouflages a bit. I'd forgotten on that as well. I think grew up playing like that.
Yes.
It's just such a trivial thing when you're playing or when you're a kid that you don't really notice a change like where extras go. But no balls scored 32 32 in this innings, is that right?
Yes.
Yeah, they scored 32 in this innings, which is a pretty handy contribution in what was a medium scoring game. Like, they could have batted at 6 or 7, I guess.
Yep.
But under modern playing conditions, that would have been 42.
Yes. Yep.
Which is, you know, handy.
Yes.
Handy knock from no balls.
I also liked we had at the end of the day's play, Richie attributed all the blame for Willis's no balling to the front foot no ball rule. And he specifically said that front foot no ball rule has a lot to answer for. And as I seem to remember Richie and the other Channel 9 commentators complaining about the front foot no ball rule until well into the 1990s they were banging on about it. So it was good to go back and hear this again.
Yeah.
All right. My next nomination is, it's probably a bit bold to claim this one for Australia, but I am going to claim it anyway because it's David Gower not being run out. And this one's mostly an umpiring decision, but there were two Australian players involved and only one England player. So on that basis, I'm claiming it for Australia. And so what happened here was that in England's first innings, Gower took off for a single and was sent back looking for a second run. He didn't hit the ball. He was at the non-striker's end. And Lilly picked up the ball and he threw it in from the deep, and Marsh gathered it and broke the stumps. And Gower was at least a metre out of his ground, at least. And, yeah. Of course, in those days, not out. And Richie Beno, who we have quoted before and we will quote again in this particular episode, exclaims, "Oh, must have only been an inch in it, I reckon."
Yeah, like as Richie is saying that on commentary over the highlights, it's a freeze frame and the stumps are broken. And I would say Gower is 2 meters out of his ground.
Yeah.
It's not like there's an inch in it. It's really just the most woefully inaccurate piece of commentary.
Yes, give him a inch, they'll take 2 meters. Anyway, the only possible explanation I thought of was that, you know, maybe these are the kind of things we think about these days. Maybe Marsh broke the stumps before he caught the ball. So I thought, all right, I'll go frame by frame. And I'm pretty sure that it hits his gloves basically the frame before he broke the stumps. Either way, I don't think any umpire could have possibly spotted him breaking the stumps, you know, 1/24th of a second before he caught the ball with the naked eye. So I'm pretty sure that wasn't the reason it was given not out.
No, there is no sign of that from anyone on the field or anyone commentary that that was the reason. I mean, certainly Richie didn't think that.
Yes. To put the cherry on the top of this particular non-decision, there was an almost identical piece of outfielding by Lilly, again throwing it in, and Marsh again took the ball in front of the stumps, and they did this to run out Embury later in the innings. And I'm almost certain Embury was a lot closer to being in his ground than Gower was.
Yeah, I would say, like, I know the one you mean, that was, I think it was the next day, and
yep.
The commentator, I'm not sure who it was, says he was easily run out. So he's given out, he said he was easily run out,
yep.
And that very matter-of-factly states, he was 2 yards out, except yep. That what you can see with your actual eyes is is totally borderline, and it isn't remotely clear whether he made his ground or not, so it's just... I don't know, it's like they got the commentary completely the wrong way around.
Yeah, the thing that I noticed about this and other moments in this particular test is it just highlights how commentators used to just say stuff that was obvious nonsense. I mean, you'd see it a lot with the LBW shouts as well. And, I was thinking that, you know, maybe modern viewers who've seen so much ball tracking, I think we've got a far better sense of, you know, the validity of an LBW decision these days. But in the pre-DRS days, you just assume the commentators were giving accurate feedback. They'd say, oh, that's, you know, bouncing over. And nah, definitely not. It's hitting, you know, on the bottom of the pad or whatever. And they were just justifying a decision after the event with all these kind of just concocted lies. They just,
yeah.
At least they supported the umpires, I guess. That's the one thing you can say for them.
I can only presume they have no, or are spurning the replay. They have no sort of like sighter of the TV footage. And they're literally just commentating on the live action, and then
yep.
Unfortunately for them, what they're saying is then later being or on their highlights being broadcast alongside these images, which are just totally undermining what they're saying. Okay, my next nomination is a Jeffrey Boycott shot, which I will leave unmentioned, like the nature of which I'll leave unmentioned for just a moment. So the first thing to highlight here is that this was Boycott's 100th test match, so
yes.
Pretty big deal for him, and you can see people people earlier in the match sort of literally standing on the outfield getting autographs from him while he's fielding, which seems like very strange to modern eyes.
Yeah, I think an official had to come in and basically say, stop signing autographs, Jeffrey.
Yeah, and he went on the bench as well. It's just like a free-for-all. He obviously wanted to do well in his 100th test match, even more than the previous 99. And in the first innings, he'd made 17. So in the second innings, England were in a position where they were very slightly behind on runs, but where the obvious goal was to get in a position where they could declare, which is something they did actually eventually do. But Jeffrey was having absolutely none of this, as you said in the description of the match. I mean, you could argue he helped lay the platform for the declaration batting that followed with that. 60 off 211 balls. But the nature of that innings, it was pretty clear where the emphasis was. And, you know, he wasn't splitting the difference between, you know, laying a platform and declaration batting. He was really just laying a platform largely for himself. I'm gonna go on a limb here and say that Jeffrey wanted 100 in his 100th test. And if the admittedly outside prospect of an England win had to be sacrificed to achieve that, then so be it. that's how it felt to me. I can't speak for Jeffrey's thoughts at the time.
That seems very unlikely that Jeff Boycott would ever bat selfishly like that. That's not what I've heard about the man.
But so he gets to 50 and he's on 50 and suddenly out of nowhere he uppercuts Jeff Wilson over the slips for four. Not a top edge, an uppercut, like a deliberately played lofted shot over the slips cord by Jeffrey Boycott batting for his 100 in his 100th test match.
Against the man who took 7 wickets in the first innings.
Against the guy who took 7 wickets in the first innings. And it's clear that it's out of nowhere because David Gower batting at four has already gone past him when this happens. He's about 60, so he's been sort of trudging along, and then he just thinks, sod it, let's just ramp one.
It was a very leisurely attempt to set a fourth innings target. I think at the end of the fourth day, they were 95 runs ahead. Boycott seemingly has no interest in setting a fourth innings target. He's just going to go as leisurely as he likes. And then sadly, he's caught behind off the bowling of Lilly on the last morning. And I think at that point, everybody else said, oh, maybe we'll go for a declaration now.
Yeah, there's quite a sort of sharp switch at that point, isn't there? Where suddenly everyone's thrashing about and you think, oh, you could have done this better earlier. Except you couldn't because half of the batters were Jeffrey Boycott.
I will move on to my final nomination. And my final nomination came in this very final innings of the test. Australia, this is Graham Wood's full toss 4. So after England, you know, came up with this tiny bit of urgency in the middle session, they set a target of 232 runs in a session and a bit. And Australia had a bit of a nervy start to their fourth innings run chase, which, you know, I'm sure won't be a problem going ahead. They ended up at 62 for 4 when Alan Border joined Graham Wood at the crease. So, you know, probably not going to lose, but, you know, definitely not going to win at that point. All they're going to do is put their head down and go for the draw. This is where Bob Willis, our man with the long front foot stride, he comes in, he bowls this wild full toss, and if it had been on target, it would have been like a near perfect beamer. It was straight out of his hand, slipped straight out, head height the entire way down the pitch. Would have, you know, hit, you know, Graham Wood fair in the scone if it had been straight, but instead it was well down leg side, and, you know, if Wood had been of an inclination, he could have just left it and watched it, you know, probably sail past the wicketkeeper for 4 wides, but he instead decides that he's picked up the trajectory and he's going to chase the ball, and he takes a step back to the leg side, spins after it, and just swats it to the boundary for 4 with a hook shot that was kind of so exaggerated that he ended up standing a couple of metres to the left of his stumps, facing directly behind him, just watching it, you know, ping to the boundary. And pretty much after that point, everybody has a look around and goes, well, that's probably enough. We should just all shake hands.
This is getting out of control.
Yeah.
It's quite the feat to lay bat on that, I would say. That's the thing that's sort of most striking about, because it's high and wide and doesn't bounce. And presumably moving fairly quickly, and he's basically got to sort of catch up with it, hit it exactly backwards.
Yeah.
One thing that struck me was between Wood's finishing position after this shot and Ray Bright's run-up, it was like some of the players were wrongly calibrated and just playing 90 degrees out from how they should have been.
Yeah.
And the other thing that struck me about this moment was when the I don't know who the commentator was, actually. It was one of the Brits, but he says, I won't do that. He did like a slightly comedy Cockney accident, and he said, slipped out of my hand, mum, was whatever. I don't know if that was like a saying or something, but it was just like...
Let's say it's a popular catchphrase in the late 70s, early 80s.
Yeah, had that air about it.
Yeah.
I thought that would be the best thing to commentate with. And to be honest, like, it was a hard one to know what to say.
Yeah.
Okay, my final nomination, I'm going to call it Ian Botham's departure as captain, which is... You have to choose your words carefully with this. So a reminder here that Botham was serving as England captain on a kind of 0 hours contract, one match at a time with no guarantee of future work. That was the arrangement. So not really an amazing situation, but a reflection of the fact that England weren't wholly convinced by how he'd been doing as captain. And another sign he was under pressure, he got really disproportionately large supportive cheers when he walked out to bat in the first innings, which is never a good sign, is it?
Yes.
It's always. He then made, he responded to this with a three-ball duck. So he walked off to a lot less applause on the way back. And again, there weren't quite so many cheers in the second innings when he walked out. And he was then bowled behind his legs first ball to record a pair. So really just having a pretty dreadful time.
Yeah, he's gone full Bob Woolmer there, hasn't he?
He has, he's gone full Bob. So the match finishes. His bowling was not so dreadful, but you know, the general picture is a man who's just lost the ability to bat and is not really enjoying captaincy too much. So the match finishes, and in the highlights from the time, Richie says that Botham immediately went to the selectors and asked to be made captain for the rest of the series, like delivering an ultimatum kind of thing. And the selector said, no, because we're sacking you.
Yep.
Botham later wrote that he had decided to resign after the game anyway, and he'd written the letter and everything, and that's what he went to speak to the selectors about. Alec Bedser, the chairman of selection, later said that Botham asked to be allowed to say he had resigned, it was Bedser who gave the interview telling everyone that they'd wanted to sack him, which I guess didn't technically rule out Botham saying that he'd wanted to resign.
Yeah.
It just rather undermined the whole, like, point of that, of Botham saying it's his decision. If you then say, actually, it's also our decision.
I'm a massive fan of these escalating levels. I wish Botham had, you know, then came back a few years later and claimed that he'd agreed to let the selectors claim they'd decided to sack him, even though he'd agreed to let them say he decided to resign because he'd already decided he didn't want the selectors to claim they'd sacked him and he'd intended to resign as agreed. I think you could just keep escalating it forever and ever. But yeah, it was very entertaining.
The mechanics of it are quite difficult to unpick, but the end result is clear that Botham was no longer England captain.
Yes.
So the Botham captaincy lasted 12 tests, which was 8 draws and 4 defeats. His bowling was not dreadful, but he'd been incredible up to that point, and he'd been very mediocre as a bowler while captain. And he'd averaged 13 with the bat, so pretty shit.
I mean, not great.
And then as for man management, which is obviously a key part of the job, speaking about his shortcomings in this area later, a few years later, he said, I didn't quite understand why you had to butter up someone and tell them they were the best thing since sliced bread to go out and play for your country, which basically just makes it sound like he treated everyone like toast.
Yeah.
and
very good.
There ends the Botham captaincy.
All right, so they're the three nominations from everybody. I do have an unnominated moment that I'd like to bring up. I think I've got a few, but we could probably take it in turns going through these.
Okay, let's have a few of those.
The one that I couldn't nominate was because it had nothing to do with either team was the bad light which ended the day's play. So I mean, I guess you could have potentially nominated this for England because Ian Botham got very furious about it, and then the crowd got very furious and they were throwing things onto the ground after the sun came out. You know, typical feral lords mob. just can never keep their emotions in check. All this, you know, controversy about the light and whether the umpires should have brought them back on or not, which kind of culminated in this entire post-stumps discussion between Richie Beno and Bob Simpson, which gave way to the phrase from Beno, I'm very keen on on light meters, which kind of tickled me for some reason.
It's I think it's the early days of light meters, isn't it? So it's a real talking point. And then they were just talking about the decision, and I swear at one point Simpson says that they took the umpires took a light meter reading in the pavilion, which is outrageous if it's true. And
Did they turn the lights on before that or not?
And if it's not true, it's almost as outrageous that Simpsons just sort of imagined it and said it on TV.
Yeah. Modern technology. Marvellous.
One moment that I liked was Rodney Marsh's LBW on the third day, where he left one that hit him on the pad and then played a shot, which is a thing you see a little bit, but it's comically late. And I assume it was just his brain going, oh, you should have done this instead. Except that even then he missed the ball, where the ball actually hit him by about a foot. So he basically played the wrong shot, even with the benefit of hindsight.
Yeah, that was very funny. I guess he was just proving that the umpire right. No matter, even if he had played the shot, he still would have been out of BW. So yes, that's excellent stuff. Last time we discussed Alan Border, I kind of had this flashback of when he played a cut shot. And I was just like, oh God, yes, I remember a zillion Alan Border cut shots from my childhood. And in this test, he pulled out the savage pull shot, which again is another and probably the final in the full array of Alan Border shots that I remember from my childhood. He would cut it really hard. He would pull it very hard. He would then hit the ground very hard, as I discussed last test. And that's about it, I think. And there may be a third shot that triggers long forgotten memories in the next test, but I don't think so. I think Alan Border's pulled out his array of two shots for me. So
his full two shot repertoire.
Yes.
Yeah. The only other things I want to mention are all kind of linked. They're just some nice bits of commentary that I really enjoyed. Two bits were about the same delivery, which was Ray Bright LBW to John Embury, and it was just sort of like, I mean, all of these are kind of like low grade gentle criticism, but it's clear what they mean.
Yes.
So Ray Bright was LBW to John Embury, and Tony Lewis said, whatever it was that got him, it wasn't turn. It's just sort of wondering out loud what it might have been, but it seems like a bit of a slight on John Embury. But then Ray Bright doesn't fare too well either, because the Aussie commentator, I'm not sure who it is, says, and this is a nice phrase, he gave the umpire a very good view of that one, which is basically like he played like this awful sweep shot and was just like trapped dead in front, which is just like a lovely opaque but damning criticism. crap cricket all around, essentially.
Yeah, it's very good.
And then a third one, which was a little bit later on, just a really, really Richie Beno line. There's some very ordinary bowling out there this morning as regards line and length. And it's very, you don't really notice it at first, and it creeps up on you, where he's basically saying the bowling has been completely shite.
Yeah, good work for Richie.
Yeah, but just in his little sort of soft way, it's lovely.
Very good.
Oh no, one other thing actually, sorry, completely separated from that. Australia only used four bowlers in the match again.
That's true, yes.
Really not big on part-timers. Lily and Lawson both got through over 60 overs.
Yes, and that was partially because I think Terry Alderman was injured in the first innings. He went off for a while, so he did the bulk of the work in the first test. And so he went off, so Lawson just filled in the Alderman role this time around, I guess, of just keep bowling until you get a lot of wickets. But yeah, the only thing that annoyed me about that was because there were only four bowlers and Alderman went off and I think Lilly completed his over and they took the final wicket halfway through an over, that meant of the four bowlers, three of them, you know, had X point X as the number of overs bowled, which just kind of upset my sense.
Yeah, it's not very satisfactory.
Yeah, I don't want three bowlers all not having a full array of overs. Very messy. All right, so who is going to win this test?
Who is going to come second behind Ray Bright's magnificent entrance in this test is the way I would phrase it.
That's my thinking as well. My argument is basically both of us laughed out loud on first viewing. I don't think you can surpass that for 3 points. Ridiculous nonsense.
I mean, the end of like the Ian Botham captaincy is such a historic moment, and Ray Bright's first ball in this test match is the absolute antithesis of that. But yet, the impact of it was all so much greater for me. Really one of the cricket moments I've enjoyed the most in recent years, I would say. Just Ray Wright sauntering in from just the most unexpected direction.
Yeah, it's, just a bit of behind the scenes. You actually saw this before I did as we were watching the highlights separately. And I just got a DM from you on Twitter, which basically said, Ray Bright, exclamation mark, what an entrance. And I was just like, oh, okay. And then you said, have you seen? I said, not yet, but I'm looking forward to now. So I had no idea what to expect. And then the instant he showed up, it was, I had to call in Kat and say, you've got to see this. This is amazing.
So, yeah, I took a screen grab of it and like the little bit of video, and I sent it to my mate and said, guess where Ray Bright comes from? And he knew it was going to be somewhere weird. So he went for like the far right of the screen.
Yeah.
But he didn't expect him to run past the non-striker, just sort of dodge the non-striker, weave past the umpire and then bowl exactly. Yeah.
All right. So we're locking that in for 3 points. I'm not sure I've got anything that gets anywhere near that or anywhere near your things. So give me what's your best out of the others?
I think that the no balls are okay. Like it's really persistent to deliver so
sustained
many
sustained comedy,
but kind of similar to the Ray Bright moment. I really like the Jeff Boycott ram shot because I really was not expecting that. It wasn't quite laugh out loud, but it was a real sort of oh hello.
Yes, not quite the same level of shock, but still, given who Jeff Boycott is, it's pretty impressive.
And then, kind of at the opposite end of the spectrum, the slow burn nature of Ian Botham's departure and all of the intrigue around it, which doesn't change a thing. I mean, the only from a cricket fan's point of view, the only crucial thing is Ian Botham was captain. He was terrible. He's no longer captain. But the just the ins and outs and intrigue of that.
And that's not even considering, you know, the full hindsight corner knowledge we have of what comes next. So
I mean, that's not to mention that. We're conspicuously not mentioning the sort of ramifications of this, but the actual, yeah, just the sort of the mechanics of the departure, I suppose, is the nomination, really.
Yeah, it's very good. Very good.
It's a bit apples and oranges. I struggle to compare those two.
I mean, the only way you could even get close to competing with Ray Bright's entrance is the startling nature of Jeff Boycott's ramp shot
or
uppercut, whatever we're going to call it. So I would say that's the best because Ian Botham's sacking or decision to resign was not exactly a surprise after this particular test.
You would say as well is that the crowd certainly thought it was on the cards. The selectors certainly thought it was on the cards. Ian Botham certainly thought it was on the cards. So it was not sort of out of nowhere in the way that Ray Bright or Jeffrey Boycott's ram shot were out of nowhere.
Yes. So I gave myself up with the non-run out of David Gower. That's a ridiculous umpiring effort rather than anything that the Australians did. So I can't really claim that.
Yeah, two Aussies, one Englishman, but the umpires. And also the sort of unfortunate timing of the commentary. I think we're going to generously say that the commentators maybe weren't seeing what we were seeing, but that's the impression that you get. But yeah, all of those things combined, I think it was a real sort of collective effort, that one.
Yes, and Graham Wood's kind of swat was again another moment of surprise, which kind of rounded out the test, but probably not enough to compete with either Jeffrey Boycott or Ian Botham, who both are much larger comical figures and and probably deserve the 2 and the 1 points.
Okay, so we'll say 3 points to Australia, 2 and 1 points to England, so a draw.
Second test, yes, which leaves England still ahead 1-0 in the Ridiculous Ashes. But that will be where we end this second Ridiculous Ashes test. So thank you for listening. You can check out Alex's website. That's over at kingcricket.co.uk. Mine is at leavecricket.com. And you can follow us on Twitter at Ridiculous Ashes, which is where you'll find the animated GIF of Ray Bright running in and delighting us all with his 3-point effort. You can also follow Alex and myself individually at the King's Tweets and at leavecricket, respectively. And we will be back in 1 week with our coverage of what I'm sure will be a very normal and uneventful third test of the 1981 Ridiculous Ashes. You can subscribe to the podcast to find out what happens there. And while you're doing so, just give us your honest 5-star ratings on the podcast store of your choice. And we will see you next week.
See ya.
Social Podcast Network.
It's time for today's Lucky Land horoscope with Victoria Cash.
Life's gotten mundane, so shake up the daily routine and be adventurous with a trip to Lucky Land. You know what they say, your chance to win starts with a spin. So go to LuckyLandSlots.com to play over 100 social casino-style games for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Get lucky today at LuckyLandSlots.com.
Available to players in the U.S., excluding Washington and Michigan. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.